I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Dr. Rita Dixon. She's the State Wildlife Action Plan Coordinator for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Today, Peter, we're talking about bats and their importance in Idaho.
Right. This is another great conversation. And Dr. Rita was with us years back.
Years ago, season one, episode three.
And we talked a little bit about bats as well.
That's right.
This conversation, we're going to bring in white nose syndrome and what that is and how it affects bats and what we can do to help slow down or prevent the spread of white nose syndrome.
We met with Rita back in 2019, if you can believe, back then, and now we're recording at the end of 24. And a lot has happened, I'm sure, in the last 5 years since we recorded that. We're going to learn a little bit more about bats and their importance here in Idaho.
Yep.
But first, before we get there, Peter, you got nature in the news.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the Seychelles warbler.
What?
The Seychelles warbler, which is native to the Seychelles Island.
Okay.
Islands. It's an island chain east of Africa in the Indian Ocean.
Indian Ocean, right.
Yes. And these warblers are socially monogamous, where male and female form a long-term pair bond and raise their young together.
How sweet.
Right. And, you know, just like humans, these warblers do get divorced.
Really?
Yes.
And are lawyers involved?
No lawyers.
No lawyers.
You know, maybe maybe an injury or a ringtail lemur will get in the middle of it, but that's neither here nor there.
Go on.
So within warblers, within the Seychelles warbler, divorce rates, which is the termination of a pair bond while both are still alive.
Huh. Okay.
Is, you know, 1 to 16% per year. And divorce is most often associated with poor reproductive success.
Oh.
And we've got some researchers, however, have found out that within this divorce rate, it actually increases significantly depending on fluctuations in rainfall prior to and during breeding seasons. So when you have an unusually dry season, divorce rate in these warblers go up. When you have an unusually wet season, lots of rain, divorce rate still goes up.
What?
Yes. So you're kind of going, this is kind of crazy. What
sure.
does this mean? What it means is that nature's a tad bit more complex than
sure.
we ever thought. And as we look at reproductive success. And with this rainfall, there wasn't necessarily a significant difference in reproductive success. So even with more rain or less rain, you know, they were still doing what they need to do. You know, nobody felt the need for a divorce except it was drier or wetter. Then they had to get a divorce.
I'm fascinated by this concept that they're, well, okay, pair bonds, that
yep.
makes sense.
Yep.
There is a divorce rate.
Yes. And that makes sense, too, especially
yep.
when you look at reproductive success.
Right.
Yes.
And so there's an advantage to having greater reproductive success. And so
mm-hmm.
that would maintain the pair bonds.
Yep.
That makes sense.
Yep.
But if it's too wet or too dry, then divorce rates increase.
Yes.
And so there's some Goldilocks climate regime that is good for pair bonds and presumably also for reproductive success.
Right.
Those things are going to go together, right?
Right.
Boy,
and this
is complicated.
This is new research. And
yeah.
when we look at, especially as our climate is changing and our weather patterns start to fluctuate even more so, and we're not looking at little fluctuations, we're looking at large fluctuations. So as we look at potential conservation needs or requirements for animals, now we have to start looking at climate effects and weather effects.
Sure. And that it'll be complicated. It's not just as simple as too wet, this happens, too
yeah.
dry, something else happens.
Yeah, we've got plenty of food, so
right.
success should be high. Nope, it's plenty of food, really wet, divorce rates go up.
Do they wear little wedding rings on their wings?
On their little
so cute.
Toes, right?
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well,
we're going to ban their wings. So,
Too good. Trivia time for today. For Idaho, what is the estimated annual value of bats to the agricultural industry by reducing pesticide use? How valuable are bats estimated to be on an annual basis here in Idaho? When we come back from the break, Dr. Rita Dixon will join us, and we're going to talk all about bats here in Idaho, so stay tuned.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command, play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Dr. Rita Dixon. She's the State Wildlife Action Plan Coordinator for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. First off, welcome to the Nature of Idaho.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
Well, it's been a while. You were with us in season one. Here we are at the beginning of season seven. But for those of us who need remembering, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
I'm the State Wildlife Action Plan Coordinator for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. And for those who aren't familiar with state wildlife action plans, these are plans across the country. Each state and U.S. territory has one. And they bring in money from the state wildlife grants program to the states for conservation. And Idaho just finished its third revision, which was approved in January of this year. So we are now working on implementing our state wildlife action plan across Idaho. That includes not just our agency, but our partners across the state, with state federal agencies, tribes, non-governmental organizations, and others.
Excellent. Well, we want to talk about bats today, and maybe just start us off a little bit about, like, bats in Idaho. I'm sure many of us have seen bats, maybe in twilight hours, flying around. Are bats a common component of ecosystems across Idaho?
Yes. Many people are surprised to find bats in town. When they call, they say, well, I've never seen a bat. And because most of the time people don't encounter bats because they're busy flying around at night eating insects, and because their primary navigation system is echolocation, we're not hearing them either, because most of our bats are echolocating at frequencies that are not audible to the human ear. However, we do have a couple of bat species in Idaho. The spotted bat is the main one that produces audible echolocation sounds at lower frequencies. And then the pallid bat, primarily during the breeding season, uses some echolocation calls that we can detect. And so most of the time when people encounter bats, it's like you described, either at twilight or if they happen to encounter a bat roosting on the side of a building or their home or their entryway, something like that. That's where most people encounter bats.
So Rita, how many bat species do we have in Idaho, and are they found throughout the entire state?
Yes, we have 14 regularly occurring bat species in Idaho. Most of them can be found in most of the state. We have some species like the spotted bat that doesn't have a statewide distribution, but many of our bats that can be found anywhere in the state and all the way up to like 10,000 feet elevation. So that also surprises people. We also have one species that has been detected probably a handful of times in Idaho, the Brazilian free-tailed bat. Some people refer to it as the Mexican free-tailed bat. We have documented it in Idaho, but it is not regularly occurring. And what I mean by that is it doesn't breed here. It's not a resident. Of our 14 bat species, all but two are year-round residents. Two of them, the silver-haired bat and hoary bat, typically migrate during the winter months, although we do have a record of a hibernating silver-haired in the state up in the Clearwater region of the state.
And I think it's great. I was surprised. You know, we automatically think that our bats all hibernate, but to have migrating bats, you know, that's pretty darn cool.
Yes, it is. And they're long distance migrants. They're, you know, our other bats will make short distance movements from their breeding grounds to where they hibernate. But we do have the two species that hightail it south in the winter.
Okay, so we've got a diversity of bats that live across the state and reside here year round. even if they're a little cryptic, I guess, for most folks, because they're doing their thing more or less silently to us and, you know, at dark times of the day. And so maybe people aren't even totally aware with them. Do they pose any danger to people? I think that's something that comes up every once in a while when people encounter them, they're maybe nervous about.
Yes. The only human health issue regarding bats in Idaho is rabies. And we discovered that bats in North America had rabies in the 1950s. The first case was a bat in Florida. And since then, we have national rabies surveillance across the country every year, including in Idaho. The Idaho Department of Health and Welfare publishes rabies positive bats on their website, and you can look back through the years and see where, you know, which counties in the state and how many bats. And one thing for everyone to understand about rabies is you can only contract the disease or be exposed to it if you have direct contact with the bats. So that's why, you know, one of the most important messages we want people to get is don't handle bats with your bare hands. Don't disturb bats, leave bats alone. So any infected animal with rabies transmits it through saliva. So basically an exposure, it's the primary mode of transmission is through a bite. But if you get scratched, and by scratch, that means breaking the skin, not just contact, but breaking the skin, or if you have contact with the saliva on a mucosal membrane, like your eye, inside your mouth, up your nose, in an open wound. You know, the likelihood of that happening is low probability unless you're messing with a bat. You know, there are situations where someone might wake up in their bedroom and find a bat flying around. And that's considered a potential exposure. And so that's where we would want people to call their public health district.
So we kind of talked, it's rare, but let's talk about what's even more important. What is the value of bats within our ecosystem and the state of Idaho?
Bats have been estimated to be worth over $313 million annually to Idaho's agricultural industry. And we all know, you know, those of us living here know how important agriculture is to our state. And that savings or the value to farmers is offsetting pesticide use. So not only does it have a direct economic impact, but it has indirect impacts, positive, not only to our own health in terms of having food that has fewer pesticides, but also to our environment in having fewer pesticides on the land.
So pesticide use and reducing pesticide use in agricultural industry, if we reduce the amount of pesticides, that saves money. And so the notion here is bats are consuming so many insects, and so we don't have to have as much pesticides sprayed on our plants. Is that the idea?
Yes. Mm-hmm. On the crops that farmers raise.
Right. And then that has a secondary health benefit to humans. You have a study that was reported out east. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, a study came out this fall in the journal Science. A researcher in the Northeast had looked at pesticide use after losing bats to the disease white nose syndrome, which I think we're going to talk about today also. And he found that with the loss of bats, farmers were increasing pesticide use on their crops to compensate for bats eating the insects. And after looking into that and studying that, he found out that was correlated with an increase in infant mortality in those counties with increased pesticide use. So there's a direct link from bats to human health. And secondary to that is the farmers who were increasing that pesticide use and the cost of that, it's also land values. Some of the land values went down there.
Yeah, so there's this sort of trickle-down effect of when bats are doing poor, then it requires a response on the human side that has a net negative impact on humans. And
yes.
So bat health directly influences human health, which is an interesting finding, right? You mentioned white-nose syndrome. We talked about this last time you were on the show. this is a really important, I think there's a general awareness of it, but I feel like there's still pockets of folks who have not heard of white nose syndrome. Could you tell us what it is and why it's important to bat populations?
Yes, so white nose syndrome is a disease of hibernating bats. It was first documented in a cave near Albany, New York in February of 2006. Based on all the research and everything we know, it appears that the fungus was introduced accidentally into North America from Eurasia, probably from Europe. Since then, the fungus and the disease has spread across North America, both in Canada and the U.S. And currently, the disease has been confirmed in 40 U.S. states and 9 Canadian provinces. Something that's important to distinguish is that the disease is what kills the bats. There are some bats that we've detected the fungus on, but it has not caused any mortality in those bats. So in Idaho, we detected the fungus that causes white nose syndrome, the disease. We first detected it in October of 2021 at Minnetonka Cave in the southeast part of the state in 3 bat species. 6 bats tested positive for the fungus, and there were 3 species, the little brown, long-legged, Myotis, and Yuma. Since then, we have been continuing to do surveillance at that site, as well as many other sites in the state, and we've had no further detections of the fungus, and we have not documented any mortality or any clinical signs of the disease. So thankfully, so far, our Idaho bats are healthy with respect to white nose syndrome.
So as I was reading an article on this, and of course, your name came up on multiple articles that I was reading about this cave, they were talking about a vaccination, a potential vaccination for white nose syndrome. Could you explain a little bit about that? And I mean, initially, I'm like, how do they administer this vaccine? And it was bat by bat.
Yes, bat by bat. We've been working with a researcher, Dr. Toni Roeke, from the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin. She's the one who developed the vaccine. It's developed from a raccoon pox virus, and it's been modified for use in bats to combat white nose syndrome. So the year that we detected the fungus at Minnetonka Cave was our first year vaccinating bats at Minnetonka Cave. And we just completed early October this year, our 4th year vaccinating bats there. We've also vaccinated bats at a maternity colony also in southeast Idaho, different site, the Oneida area. We've vaccinated bats there for 3 years. So initially, these have been part of what's called vaccine trials, experimental vaccine trials. And it started in Wisconsin, and then it's now, we're doing it in Idaho, they're doing it in Washington State, Texas, Wyoming. And so the application is an oral delivery of the vaccine via pipette into the bat's mouth. So it's labor intensive because you have to first capture the bat, have the bat in hand, administer the vaccine. That's what we've been doing so far. And then the researcher, Dr. Roeke, is working on a topical application, probably spraying the bats. The idea there is bats groom themselves, and they groom themselves by combing their fur with their toes and then licking their toes to moisten them. And they would be ingesting the vaccine, so basically vaccinating themselves. And that way, we would be able to treat large numbers of bats instead of a bat-by-bat approach, which is not feasible long-term to get the vaccine into the population.
So with the present vaccine, are you trying to go into the hibernaculum and vaccinate all the bats, or are you looking at a certain percentage? And I'm assuming that once they've been vaccinated, you've tagged them so you can identify them and all that, because we're talking thousands of bats within one cave.
Yes, what we've done is target with the vaccine trial, we've targeted trying to capture about 150 bats each time, and half of those get the vaccine and half get a placebo. And that's because it's an experiment. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we can't vaccinate all of them. And Minnetonka Cave serves as a hibernaculum for well over 1,000 bats, including over 800 Myotis species, which are the species most impacted by white nose syndrome. So that's one of the reasons we targeted Minnetonka for the vaccine trial, also because it's a commercial show cave. So we get people from all over visiting there. And that increases the risk when we have a lot of humans, because potentially the fungus can be moved around, transported on clothing, shoes, and gear.
Right. And so the notion here is there's a fungus, and you're not really trying to limit the growth of the fungus with the vaccine. It's if it gets into the system of the bat won't express the disease.
One of the things they found from the bats in Wisconsin that's in what's called the endemic zone for white nose syndrome, where white nose syndrome has been there for years now, it's showing that one, fungal loads on the bats' wings are lower for vaccinated bats. So one of the reasons bats can contract the disease is if fungal loads are really high, that increases their vulnerability to the actual manifestation of the disease. So we want lower fungal loads. That's one of the objectives.
That makes sense. Also, obviously, a strategy is to try to limit the spread of the fungus itself. So what can folks do, and what are the protocols involved when people are traveling into cave systems, for example, where bats are known to hibernate, to limit the options or the possibility of spreading these bad fungi into the cave system?
The most important thing people can do if they are recreating underground or anywhere where we have bats is if they have been in a cave, for example, in a state that is white nose positive, we do not want them bringing anything they have worn in that cave into Idaho, because that puts our bats at risk. And there are national decontamination protocols for white nose syndrome on the whitenosesyndrome.org website, which is our national response team website. And anyone interested can go there and see how they can protect bats and what they need to do. Their decontamination. So like in Idaho, within the state, if you're moving from one cave to another, we would want you to decontaminate your gear between caves. Because we don't know right now, there could be places that have the fungus that we just haven't detected. So as precautionary measures within the state, we want people decontaminating. We would prefer that people do not bring any gear from outside the state into one of our caves. And if they've been in a cave and they're wearing the same clothes or shoes, we don't want them going into caves here unless they're using different equipment. Clothing.
So what are some signs for us in the general public to look for or notice that might signal there's a cave or bats that are affected by the white nose syndrome disease?
Some of the things to be aware of is unusual mortality, and unusual mortality with bats is defined as five or more dead or sick bats at the same place at the same time. For example, you go into a cave, you find five dead bats on the floor of the cave. That triggers a call to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game to report it so that we can investigate. And sometimes it's another reason, like we had an incident this summer where someone went into a cave and shot and killed a lot of bats. So unusual mortality is one thing to look for. If people are going into caves during the winter, hopefully not into hibernacula, but if they are and they encounter bats, between pretty much November to May is the primary time of year when you can see clinical signs. Typically later in hibernation, when fungal loads are higher, if they see the characteristic white fungal hyphae on the muzzle of the bat, it can be on any of the unfurred parts of a bat, their nose, their ears, their forearms. They're typically probably not going to see the tail when a bat's roosting. It's usually they're going to see it on the muzzle. So that's of a concern. Sometimes, you know, bats that are infected will try to fly out earlier and then they're just going to be out on the landscape, either dead or weak or dehydrated from the fungus. So those are some of the things to keep in mind. But finding one dead bat is not, you know, bats die. But if you find a bat and it's covered with a fungus, yeah, we would like to know about that. And we have had some of those reports and we've tested them and they've been other fungi that are in caves that just colonize decomposing animals.
And that's okay to call if you don't know. And I think because we've got 14 species and they range all the way across Idaho, there is no way that you guys can keep track of every hibernacula or every location that bats are found. So to really help minimize and slow down and reduce the spread of white nose, we really do rely on our community's help and notifying you guys.
Mm-hmm. And an example of the importance of public reporting is the first detection of white nose syndrome in Washington state was a bat found on the ground on a trail by hikers. And they took that bat to a rehabilitator and the bat died and was sent off for testing and it was confirmed for white nose syndrome. So that's why, you know, eyes and ears out on the, you know, across the state are important and valuable to us. But, you know, after the hibernation season, you know, once we get past May, the likelihood during the summer of seeing any clinical signs is virtually nil. So we get calls during the summer. It's not likely that you would see any clinical signs. Highly, highly unlikely.
That sounds good. Well, and it's very clear, like the bats are, even if they're a little cryptic to most folks, they're really, really important parts of the ecosystem in their own right, let alone they have added benefit to human society and how we go about maintaining our crops and maintaining our own local health. And so it's to everyone's advantage to see these bats succeed. And so it's wonderful that they're here, and we're thankful for the work that you and your team are doing. Can you help us with our trivia question up front, which is kind of a repeat, actually. If you were paying attention in 2019, this was kind of a question back then. It's worth really reiterating that, again, from an ecosystem standpoint and in their own right, they are valuable. But if that case didn't persuade you, they are also financially valuable, right? And so our question is, for Idaho as a state, what is the estimated annual value of bats to the agricultural industry by reducing pesticide use?
In Idaho, bats are worth over $313 million annually to our state's agricultural industry. And to emphasize, recognize that, we had our governor issue a proclamation some years back to that effect during National Bat Week, recognizing the value of bats to our state and how important they are.
That's really important. $333 billion every year. That is a direct monetary value of bats. So let's do our job, right?
Right. And I'm going to say, anyone who's curious, find a picture of a spotted bat, and you will realize that even our little insectivorous bats are as cute as these fruit bats over in Australia and Africa and such. Rita, thank you so much for joining us today to talk to us again about bats in Idaho. And for all who really want to learn more about our precious bats and white nose syndrome, please visit the Idaho Department of Fish and Game website and search for the Wildlife Health tab. So again, thank you very much, Rita.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noid-kisu@isu.edu.